Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, Phil Dierking tells us about efforts to save Paris's bookselling tradition. Kelly Jean Kelly has another report on key Supreme Court cases in American history. This week, she looks at a 2015 decision that made gay marriage legal in every state. We end our program with another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first, here are Anna Mateo and Pete Musto with this week's science report.
As temperatures rise in the western part of the United States, wildfires grow in size as well. The Associated Press has studied information on weather and wildfires from the last 35 years. The media group's findings show that the years in which wildfires burned the highest number of hectares were also years with the hottest weather. The report said the amount of land burned in wildfires has more than doubled. Fires need something to cause them to start. They also require oxygen and fuel to keep them going. The report says global warming increases the supply of fuel by drying trees and other plants. Mike Flanagan, a fire scientist with the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada, spoke to the Associated Press. Hotter, drier weather means our fuels are drier, so it's easier for fires to start and spread and burn more intensely, Flanagan said.
The period of April to September is fire season in the U.S. The National Interagency Fire Center is the governmental group responsible for organizing the country's efforts to fight wildfires. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, studies weather conditions. Data from the two agencies demonstrates that higher air temperatures are severely affecting conditions during fire season. Since 1983, the five hottest fire seasons in the western U.S. produced fires that, on average, burned more than 35,000 square kilometers. That is three times the average for the five coldest fire seasons. So far this summer, temperatures in the western United States have reached more than 1.7 degrees Celsius above the 20th century average. In July, California recorded its hottest month in 124 years of record keeping. The Associated Press examined the federal fire data from the last 35 years. It found that the fire seasons that had the largest fires were in years that temperatures reached several degrees hotter than the 20th century average. Tim Brown is the Western Regional Climate Center Director for NOAA. He said the fuel wetness levels in California and Oregon are close to record lows. Jennifer Balch is a University of Colorado fire scientist. She said that reduced wetness in the air is the key driver of wildfire spread. She predicted the western U.S. soon will start to see wildfires of over 400,000 hectares.
Longtime Colorado firefighter Mike Sagaski used to consider 4,000-hectare fires big. Now he fights fires 10 times that size and more. You kind of keep saying, how can they get much worse? But they do, Sagaski said. The number of U.S. wildfires has not changed much over the last few decades, but the size of areas burned has greatly increased. Randy Erdley is chief spokesman for the National Interagency Fire Center. He pointed to the year 2000 as some kind of turning point in wildfires. From 1983 to 1999, the United States had less than 26,000 square kilometers burned each fire season. Since then, there have been 10 years in which more than 26,000 square kilometers have burned. The largest burns took place in 2017, 2015, and 2006. The wildfires in each of those years burned more than 38,000 square kilometers. Some people who reject climate science point to data that seems to show far more land burned in the 1930s and 1940s. But Erdley said data before 1983 is not dependable. Nationally, more than 23,050 square kilometers have burned this year. That is already 28% more than the 10-year average, and fire season continues.
Scientists generally avoid blaming global warming for any given extreme event without extensive research. But fire and weather scientists have done those extensive examinations of wildfires. John Abatskalou of the University of Idaho looked at forest fires and dry conditions in the western United States. The data covered the years 1979 to 2015. He compared that data to computer-based models of what would be expected with no human-caused climate change. He concluded that global warming was partly to blame for an extra 42,000 square kilometers of forests burning since 1984. The 2015 Alaska fire season is the second biggest on record. A similar comparison with a computer-based model found that human-based climate change increased the fire risk by 34 to 60%. One 2015 study said worldwide fire seasons are about 18.7% longer since 1979. Another study that year said climate change is increasing extreme wildfire risk in California, where wildfires already are year-round. Also, insects and a lack of water have killed 129 million trees in California since 2016, creating more fuel. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke recently told Breitbart Radio that what's driving increased wildfires is an increase in fuel. He said the government has been held hostage by environmental terrorist groups. These groups oppose clearing dead trees that they say act as homes for animals. However, Zinke did admit that climate change did play a part in worsening wildfires. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Bouquinistes is the French word to call sellers of old books along the Seine River in Paris. The tradition has existed for over 400 years. However, modern technology like electronic book readers and sellers of books online are now hurting their profits and threatening their existence. To save the trade, the Bouquinistes are now trying to be added to UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage List. The list recognizes and protects traditions and living expressions passed on from family members. David Nozek is one such Bouquiniste. He is busy reading a book and rarely looks at the tourists walking by. A few stop to examine old books and artworks on his green metal stand. I like to read. I like old things. And there's an independence to the business, he said. We certainly don't get into it to get rich. Sophie Leleux supports the effort to be added to UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage List. She thought it would be a good way to maintain the quality of the trade. If we're on the UNESCO list, we become like the Egyptian pyramids or the Venetian gondoliers. Nobody can remove us, she added. First, the bouquinists need to make France's own intangible heritage list, and the difficult process can take several years. France can only support one candidacy every 2 years for the UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage bid. So far, UNESCO has only accepted 15 out of 400 that made the French list. But not everyone, including some bouquinists, supports the idea. Some fear they will no longer be able to sell the souvenirs that helped them survive. Francis Robert has been selling old comic books for 40 years. He said intangible cultural heritage status might seem like a good idea, but the money from souvenirs like keychains and small Eiffel Tower statues has allowed him to continue selling books. Megan Patton, a visitor from Philadelphia, said with the bouquinists, "You get the feel of Paris. They're part of what makes the city so special." However, some travelers are not as interested in the bouquinists. Colorado author Mike McPhee, who has visited Paris many times, said he would not trust their books to be real and would rather buy from a trusted dealer. Florence Berthoud is mayor of Paris's 5th district. She said, "There's an urgency to defend the bouquinists' trade. The district is in the center of the Latin Quarter, home to the Sorbonne, one of the world's first universities. Its town hall faces the Pantheon, where some of France's greatest writers and academics are buried. The area is also home to the majority of Parisian bookstores, publishing houses, and most of the city's bouquinists." "There's nothing more democratic than books," said Berthoud. She is the daughter of farmers from central France and discovered famous writers like Shakespeare and Émile Zola thanks to low-cost books her parents bought. Berthoud says that UNESCO intangible cultural heritage status would give bouquinists more recognition and hopefully increase their sales. This would allow them to continue selling old books and not cheap souvenirs. But few people believe the bouquinists will completely disappear from Paris. There are more than 200 today, compared to less than 30 in the 17th century. I'm Phil Dierking.
The Supreme Court often looks at a major social issue over a series of cases. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, it considered the rights of gay people. At the time, voters in many states had approved laws strongly limiting gay rights. For example, police in Texas were permitted to arrest same-sex partners. Around the same time, voters in other states began permitting official same-sex unions. Like voters, the Supreme Court's members were divided about the issue. But in three cases, a majority struck down laws limiting homosexual relationships. The fourth case was brought by a man named Jim Obergefell. He had married a man named John Arthur in the state of Maryland, where gay marriage was legal. but the couple lived in another state, where it was not. 3 months after they were married, Arthur died. The question was, what would the official death certificate say? Was Arthur married or not? The dispute made its way to the Supreme Court in 2015. 5 of the 9 justices sided with Obergefell. Yes, they said, he and Arthur were married, and the death certificate must say so. Their decision made gay marriage legal in every state.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Soon after his presidency began, there was an attempt on his life. A gunman shot President Reagan in March 1981. Doctors removed the bullet. He rested, regained his strength, and returned to the White House in 12 days. The new president wanted to reduce the size of the federal government. He and other conservative Republicans wanted less government interference in the lives of Americans. President Reagan won congressional approval for his plan to reduce income tax rates. Many Americans welcomed the plan. Others were concerned about its effects on the national debt. They saw taxes go down while defense spending went up. To save money, the Reagan administration decided to cut spending for some social programs. This pleased conservatives. Liberals, however, said it limited poor people's chances for good housing, health care, and education. President Reagan also had to make decisions about using military force in other countries. In 1983, he sent Marines to Lebanon. They joined other peacekeeping troops to help stop fighting among competing groups. On October 23rd, a truck carrying explosives bombed Marine housing at Beirut International Airport.
There was nothing in its appearance to suggest it was any different than the trucks or cars that were normally seen on and around the airport. But this one was different. At the wheel was a young man on a suicide mission. The truck carried some 2,000 pounds of explosives, but there was no way our Marine guards could know this. Their first warning that something was wrong came when the truck crashed through a series of barriers. The guards opened fire, but it was too late. The truck smashed through the doors of the headquarters building in which our Marines were sleeping and instantly exploded.
241 Americans were killed. Two days later, Marines led an invasion of the Caribbean island nation of Grenada. Communist forces were rebelling against the government there. Cuban soldiers were guarding the streets. President Reagan said he feared for the safety of American students at a medical school in Grenada. He sent the Marines to get them out safely. The Marines quickly defeated the communist forces. Many Americans were pleased. Others were angry. They said Grenada was invaded only to make people forget about what happened in Lebanon. The next year, 1984, was a presidential election year. It looked like no one could stop President Reagan. His warm way with people had made him hugely popular. He gained support with the military victory in Grenada. And by the time the campaign started, inflation was under control. The Republican Party renominated Ronald Reagan for president and George Bush for vice president. There were several candidates for the Democratic Party's nomination. One was the first African American to seek the presidency, Jesse Jackson. He was a Protestant clergyman and a longtime human rights activist. The candidate who finally won the nomination was Walter Mondale. He had been a senator and had served as vice president under President Jimmy Carter. The vice presidential candidate was Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro. It was the first time a major party in the United States had nominated a woman for national office.
Tonight, the daughter of working Americans tells all Americans that the future is within our reach if we're willing to reach for it.
One issue in the election campaign was taxes. Political candidates often try to avoid talking about taxes with voters. But former Vice President Mondale did talk about the issue. He said taxes would have to be raised to pay for new government programs.
The American people will have to pay Mr. Reagan's bills. The budget will be squeezed. Taxes will go up, and anyone who says they won't is not telling the truth to the American people.
This was a serious political mistake. President Reagan gained even more support as a result. The two candidates agreed to debate on television. During one debate, President Reagan looked old and tired. He did not seem sure of his answers, yet his popularity was not damaged. On Election Day, he won 59% of the popular vote. On Inauguration Day, the weather was bitterly cold in Washington. All inaugural activities, including the swearing-in ceremony, were held inside. President Reagan's first term began with an attempt on his life. 6 months after his second term began, he faced another threat. Doctors discovered and removed a large growth from his colon. The growth was cancerous. The president was 74 years old. Yet once again, he quickly regained his strength and returned to work. For years, the United States had accused Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi of supporting international terrorist groups. It said he provided them with weapons and a safe place for their headquarters. In January 1986, the United States announced economic actions against Libya. Then it began military training exercises near the Libyan coast. Libya said the Americans were violating its territory and fired missiles at them. The Americans fired back, sinking two ships. On April 5th, a bomb destroyed a dance club in West Berlin. An American soldier and another person were killed. The United States said Libya was responsible. President Reagan ordered a bombing raid on the Libyan cities of Tripoli and Benghazi. Muammar Gaddafi escaped unharmed, but said his adopted daughter was killed. Some Americans said the raid was cruel. Others praised it. President Reagan said the United States did what it had to do. The president also wanted to intervene in Nicaragua. About 15,000 rebel troops, called Contras, were fighting the country's communist government. President Reagan asked for military aid for the Contras. Congress rejected the request. In fact, it banned all aid to the Contras. At that same time, Muslim extremists in Lebanon seized several Americans. The Reagan administration looked for ways to gain the release of the hostages. It decided to sell missiles and missile parts to Iran in exchange for Iran's help. After the sale, Iran told the extremists in Lebanon to release a few American hostages. Not long after, serious charges became public. Reports said that money from the sale of arms to Iran was used to aid the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Several members of the Reagan administration resigned. It appeared that some had violated the law. President Reagan said he regretted what had happened, but he said he had not known about it. Investigations and court trials of those involved continued into the 1990s. Several people were found guilty of illegal activities or of lying to Congress. No one went to jail. Most Americans did not blame the president for the actions of others in his administration. They still supported him and his policies. They especially supported his efforts to deal with the Soviet Union. At the beginning of his first term, President Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire. To protect the United States against the Soviets, he increased military spending to the highest level in American history. Then, in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. Reagan and Gorbachev held four summit meetings in Geneva, Switzerland, Reykjavik, Iceland, Washington, and Moscow. Each leader agreed to destroy hundreds of nuclear missiles. President Reagan also urged General Secretary Gorbachev to become more democratic. He spoke about the Berlin Wall, which communists had built to prevent citizens from crossing between East and West Berlin.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
About this time, a new sense of glasnost, or openness, was beginning in the Soviet Union. It was also a time of perestroika, or restructuring. The American economy grew rapidly during Ronald Reagan's presidency, but at the end of his second term, many Americans were concerned by what he left behind. Increased military spending, together with tax cuts, had made the national debt huge. The United States owed thousands of millions of dollars. The debt would be a political issue for presidents to come. Yet Ronald Reagan will be remembered as one of America's most popular presidents. Above his burial place at the Reagan Library in California are these words which speak to Reagan's belief in humanity. I know in my heart that man is good, that what is right will always eventually triumph, and there is purpose and worth to each and every life.
And that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Thompson.